Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Sahadiryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhitamastu Mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Verse 12.
Upadau yata bhedata sanmaninam. Upadhyau yata bhedata sanmaninam. Tata bhedata buddhi bhedeshatepi. Tata bhedata buddhi
bhedeshatepi. Let's start from the beginning.
Upadhyau yata bhedata sanmaninam. Upadhyau yata bhedata sammaninam tatha bhedata buddhi bhedeshatepi tatha bhedata buddhi bhedeshatepi yatha chandrikanam jale chanchalatvam yatha chandrikanam jale chanchalatvam tatha chanchalatvantav Tavapi iha Vishnu, tata chanchalatvam tavapi iha Vishnu.
This is the first verse, and it's the last verse. It's the first time he doesn't say, I am that Atma who is nitya, who is limitless, who is changeless, timeless consciousness. Now the last verse is more of an acknowledgement of Vishnu, of the Lord. So, very beautiful. He says, upadau yata bhedata sanmaninam. Yata, just as upadau, in an upadi. Remember, the upadi is the any conditioning adjunct. Usually we use it for the body as an upadi, I can take myself to be the body. The mind is an upadi, I can take myself to be the mind or the sense organs or organs of action or my prana. I can identify that as myself. That's what makes an upadi. And so here, he says, just as upadau in an upadi, in a conditioning adjunct, right? Bedata sanmaninam. Money is a jewel. So a sanmani is a very pure crystal, like a pure, very clear crystal. So just as for clear crystals, they appear different. Literally, it says there's bhedata. There is a state of being different, being other. For very clear crystals, when seen in an upadi, reflected in an upadi, an example, that very common example they use is, the crystal is called a spatika. So imagine a spatika, a large crystal, and somebody brings a red flower up behind it. This example Swamiji always uses. Brings a red flower up behind the spatika, behind this crystal clear crystal. It's not, it has no color, it's absolutely transparent, and it's shiningly transparent. So somebody brings a clear, like a red cloth, a red flower up near it, and that upadi, the crystal, then acts as an is affected by the red flower that is acting as an upadi. It's a conditioning adjunct which makes the crystal appear as though red, even though from the standpoint of the crystal it remains absolutely clear, but in the vicinity of the red flower, the crystal shines as though it is red. So the red flower becomes a conditioning adjunct to the spatika, to the crystal. So you can see how this word for upadi was translated as a conditioning adjunct. Adjunct means it's related to it because close to it, and it conditions it. Like that, the body-mind sense organs is very close to my being, and it conditions it. It makes it appear as though other than what it is, even though itself is undergoing no change whatsoever. So he's using this example. He starts with just as clear crystals become different. They appear differently in the vicinity of an upadhi, of a conditioning adjunct. Tatha, similarly, bedata buddhibedeshu tepi. You also, Vishnu, hey Vishnu, you also, Vishnu really is Brahman, right? It's just like the pot really is only clay. When we say Ishwara, Ishwara is really Brahman, the conscious being, you know, for whom this whole creation comes, is sustained and resolves. But when the creation is there, Brahman, the self, appears to be all of these things, appears to be omniscient, appears to be a sarvajnaha, appears as though entering into each jiva, as giving each jiva consciousness, and then each jiva is different because of their upadis. And so Vishnu, who is really Brahman, becomes manifest in so many different ways because of the upadis, because of the conditioning adjuncts, not because Brahman has become anything different. So he says here, so just as these spatikas, these crystals, appear differently, bedata, when in conjunction with an upadhi, upadhyau yata bedata san maninam, tata, similarly, you also, hey Bhagavan, see, hey Bhagavan, you also, hey Vishnu, you appear bedata differently, buddhi bedeshu, in all of the different buddhis. Beda means different. Buddhi means buddhis, all of the different intellects, all of the different minds. You appear to be so different. Every person here is a different person, you know. Every person has their own has their own thoughts, their own feelings, their own upbringing, their own relationships, their own levels of knowledge, their own world of experiences. Everybody has a totally different perspective also. Like if you just think, it's really interesting, if you just think in this room right now with all of us in here, none of us are seeing the same thing because we're at a slightly different angles. So our perception, just our physical perception, is different, you know? And not only that, the filter through which our perception comes in terms of all of our experience also is different. Also, our understanding of the words that are being used are different because our words are conditioned in different ways. The meaning or the essential meaning that we give to the words we use, the emotional load on the words that we use, give a different sense of what is being said. That's why teaching Vedanta is such a serious matter, because the words have to be, all of the words that are being used have to be defined and over and over again to keep pointing to the words in all different directions, because the student is hearing the words through their own lens. Right, through their own lens. And even in the satsang, in the question, when the question answer, when we have satsang, you always hear how what you have said has been misunderstood in reference to how you were meaning it. Not that they misunderstood it, they understood it just fine within their context. See what I mean? And so these are the upadhis, are many and varied. And so in this creation, Bhagavan Vishnu, who will take Vishnu on two levels, just as the Satchit Ananda, the limitless conscious being that I am, you know, who as Ishwara is taken to be Ishwara from the standpoint of the Ishwara Upadhi, the whole Maya Upadhi that manifests, the whole Upadhi now is is enjoying the conscious being which I am. And how is it enjoying the form that the Maya Upadhi now is known? See how they call it the Sameshti Upadhi. Sameshti Upadhi. Upadhi means the total. Sameshti is total. the total conditioning adjunct. We're all vyashti upadis. We're like parts to a whole. So we're the limited upadis that are make up part and parcel of the sameshti. The sameshti upadi enjoys me, the conscious being, the self of Vishnu. But from the standpoint of the sameshti, the total maya upadi, I, just pure conscious being, become sarvajnaha. As Ishwara, I become sarvajnaha, omniscient. Jnaha means the one who knows. Sarva means everything. The one who knows everything is the one who's omniscient. I become what we call sarva shaktiman, the one who has all capacity, omnipotent. You know, in all of the religions of the world, when we talk about God, he's omniscient, he's omnipotent. We have all of these words. He's transcendent and immanent, you know, these kind of words. Well, we use those words too. When we talk about Ishwara, he's omniscient, he's omnipotent, right? He's all-pervasive. So I become, from the standpoint of the Ishwara Upadi, the Maya Upadi, which allows for there to be Ishwara, the Lord. Otherwise, there's just Brahman. It's just consciousness. It's only with the Maya Upadi that that conscious being, Brahman, shines in so many ways as omniscient, omnipotent, all-pervasive, you know, all fame, all glory, whatever you want to say, the creator of all that is. All of these words apply to Ishwara. And then within Ishwara, again, everything is part of Ishwara. Every jiva, limitless, countless jivas, abiding in all of these different worlds of experience. What is it? Seven lokas up and seven lokas down. Seven worlds up, seven worlds down. Seven worlds up. Each one is more subtle than the other until you get to the satya loka. More subtle means more ananda. There's less resistance, more antakarana shuddhi for all of the jivas, more subtle plane, so much more natural abiding, natural reflection of myself as I go up. Seven worlds down, much less. More tension till we get to the patala, the finally hell worlds. Because I feel separated from myself. But all of these jivas, all of these different aspects of Ishwara, right? Jivas, including, just think this, all of the plants, all of the insects, all of the mosquitoes, you know, millions and billions and billions and billions of jivas, and then the human beings and the monkeys and all of the, you know, mammalian, all of the mammals, all of the fish, they're all jivas, and all experiencing, having the same atma, the same one conscious being, but all of them acting as upadis, right? All of those conditioning adjuncts are upadis for myself. They make myself appear differently. Where in fact, the self of the fish is the self of the mosquito, is self of the good person, is the self of the bad person, is the self of Ishwara, is the self of the entire creation, both sentient and inert. From my own standpoint, I am what I am. From the standpoint of the spatika, the crystal is what the crystal is. The crystal's not becoming red, but as viewed from the other side, right? Viewed from the other side, the crystal is now red. But from its own standpoint, it's the crystal. And nothing has happened to it when the red flower comes next to it. It appears as though red, but it isn't red. Right? Like that, when my buddhi, every thought that comes through, acts as an upadi, right? It acts as a conditioning adjunct. And if I have a jnanam, I'm on the other side of that experience. You know what I mean by the other side? If I were abiding, if the aham, the me, was identified with me, then like the sun, I would be illumining that buddhi. But it's acting as an upadi, really, out of ignorance, right? Because now I am taking on the dress, the moods, the emotions, the thoughts, the everything that's going on in the mind, I'm taking it on as belonging to myself. It's acting as an upadhi. And so think of, just from the standpoint of the jivas, all contained within one infinite Ishwara, how many upadhis are there? Really, it's incredible to think how many ways am I taken to be, right? Even if you go up into the heaven world, for those different heaven worlds, the higher worlds, if you can, if you've read any like the Ramayana, the Mahabharata, and you get to know all these devas and devatas and all these heroes and heroines, all of them are upadhis, with all of their various powers and whatnot. All only upadhis of only me, you know. So here he's praising Bhagavan. He says, you know, just as a spatika appears differently in the presence of an upadhi, so do you also, hey Bhagavan, you appear differently, you know, in these conditioning adjuncts that we call the buddhis. So many buddhis, all of the individual buddhis of the jiva, and then the infinite Hiranyagarbha of Ishwara. Hiranyagarbha is like an infinite buddhi. It's like an infinite sukshma sharira. It's the infinite sukshma sharira of the samashti that holds all of the vyashti, all of the individual upadhis together. Like all of the, think of, you have to use your imagination here, but think of, like if I look at the ocean, all of the waves in the ocean make up the ocean, right? And so the ocean is physical. It's like the tamas, it's the physical expression of Ishwara, right? And so all of these waves become part and parcel of the ocean. Now what if the ocean had a subtle body? Right? That subtle body, which it doesn't, but we're just imagining it, that subtle body would be, the ocean would be called Virat. Virat means the physical expression of this creation. The subtle body would be the subtle expression. That would be called Hiranyagarbha, or the Antaryami, the one who runs through, subtly runs through and connects all of the waves in the whole ocean together. That would be called Hiranyagarbha, and it would be the subtle laws that allow the functioning of each one of our sukshma shariras, subtle bodies, which are subtle. And so there's a subtle plane which holds all of these together. And I guess you could kind of think that's why a phenomena like telepathy, you know, synchronicity, all of these type of things take place, because there's a relationship on a subtle level that also holds everything together. So that's what we would call Hiranyagarbha. So here, all of the buddhis, we have the buddhi as though the subtle laws that hold the whole creation together. And then as part of that, each individual being, your buddhi is intellect, your intellect. All of those I am on the other side of as an ajnani. Means that I experience myself through the lens, first of all, on a physical level of this body. Through the lens of my body, I experience myself. Through the lens of my mind, I experience myself. Right? And so, through the lens of my sense organs, I experience myself. The sense myself, in fact, is not changed or modified in any way by these body, mind, sense organs. It's why we call them upadhis. In reality, they don't bring about any change to me. And he's recognizing this me now is really Brahman. It's really the very self of Ishwara. So he says, just like, oh Bhagavan, you know, just for you also, just like an upadhi, a conditioning adjunct, you know, makes the spatika go red, like, or blue or black or whatever the upadhi is that comes up next to it, like that, this whole creation is making you appear in millions and millions and millions of different ways, right? All because you are being seen and appreciated through the lens of the upadis. I can even worship you in many different ways as Ishwara. I can worship you in the form of Krishna. Then I'm seeing you in the form of Krishna. You're being the Brahman that you are. Now I'm seeing through the lens of Krishna, or I'm seeing through the lens of Shiva, or I'm seeing through the lens of Jnaneshwari, through the goddess, or I'm seeing through the lens of Ganapati, or I'm seeing through the lens of any, what I call my Ishta Devata, any form of the Lord that I'm worshipping. Or I see you through the lens of your infinite dress. That's also a lens. It's also an upadi. Because actually the only thing that is here is me, this non-dual consciousness, which is my very being. So he says, so similarly, you also appear so differently through all of these different buddhis. Because all of these buddhis are different, right? And I'm looking at myself through the lens of those buddhis. And he gives another example. He says, yatha, just as for different moons, the moon, but there's many moons, because imagine waters, different waters. The moon can be reflected many different times, many in many different places. You know, say you have 100 puddles of water, there's going to be 100 moons reflected, one in each puddle of water. Now say one puddle of water, the moon is reflected in it, and that puddle of water is moving, chanchalatvam. Chanchala means it's moving, it's rippling. And then when you look at the moon in that rippling water, the moon is rippling. So he says, just like the chanchalatvam, this motion, this movement, jale, in the water, for all of the moons, right? It's only one moon, but for all of the moons, any movement that's there in the water where they're being reflected, there is chanchalatvam, you know, there's chanchalatvam, that movement for the moon, because there's movement in the water. The moon there in the water is moving. So he says, tata, similarly, there's even, he says, chanchalatvam tava api, there is even movement for you. He says, for you, hey, Bhagawan, here in this world, there's all this movement, all this activity for you, Vishnu. Hey, Vishnu. He goes, Vishnu. Vishnu means, hey, Vishnu, there's so much movement for you. There's so much activity going on for you here in this world, just as though you're just like a moon, right? You're just like a moon who's rippling and changing in all of the reflections of the water. Here in this world, you seem to be rippling and changing as the world goes on changing. You also continually change, where in fact, there's no movement for you at all. There's no change for you at all. So, he addresses Vishnu, and kind of in praise of his Maya, you know. Because in reality, your being, which is the very self of Vishnu, there are two selves. It's just your being. Vishnu's self is yourself. You can say it like that. Somehow that sounds psychologically better. Vishnu's self, Ishwara's self, is yourself. There's no independent self. There's only one self, which all beings enjoy. But from the standpoint of the upadhi, and all of the individual upadhis within the Samashti upadhi, that self is appearing in so many different forms, because it is always being viewed from the lens of the upadhi. Whether it be the lens of Krishna, always on the other side of the upadhi. So it's either the lens of Krishna, or Rama, or a devata, or a hellish figure, or it's through the lens of an animal, or a spider, or a human being. It's through the lens of a good human being and a bad human being. It's through the lens of a person that you like and through the person that you don't like. There's only one person. So interesting. The person that you have a problem with, that's an upadhi. You're having a problem with an upadhi of yourself. Right? It's the conditioning adjunct of you. But yourself isn't having any problem at all. The beautiful thing is that you know so, so very profoundly, so very deeply who the other person is. And you also know the power because of, you know, what it is to have an upadhi yourself, the physical body. You have this physical body, yourself is there, right, as the pure jewel, right? The changeless jewel, very much affected when viewed through this physical body, as are all beings. And then when I am viewed through my emotional life, you know, that's a wild ride. It can be a very wild ride. Viewed through my buddhi, you know, it's different for every person, and yet it's the same. It is the same in this way. When we look at each other, we all know we're human beings, even though we all look very different. We're all very unique, but we have the human being blueprint, right? We're all come out of the same blueprint, even though we're all unique. And also, it's also true for our psyche. Our psyches are what Jung would call the collective unconscious. It's not that there's one big Ishwara. He actually didn't mean that. He's used it in different ways, but the primary way he uses collective unconscious is in the sense that our psyches are also a blueprint. You know, they're all the same. They have the same blueprint, out of the same blueprint, but then they're exposed to so many different circumstances. The different parts of the psyche are excited in different ways, but it is the same blueprint. So we all know what it is to be happy and what it is to be sad, to be jealous, to be afraid, to be envious, to be angry, to be hateful. We know what all these words, we have words for all of these things, and they are shared words. We all know what they mean. And we all know that there's different degrees of each one of these emotions. We all know that we have an intellect. We all know about dharma, adharma, kind of the moral code of the creation. We're all very familiar with it, you know, because we're all of the same fabric. We're all of the same blueprint. You know? Now, we have to extend that recognition of ourselves and this particular human blueprint to all the other beings in the world. They're not all that different. We think they're different. It's hard to get under their skin to really know how they're feeling and thinking, but they are me. Who's inside of that little dog, you know? Who's inside of that cow? Who's inside of that spider? It's only me. There's only one me, you know? And so the consciousness that any being enjoys is me. It's not a reflection of me. It is me. I'm not a reflection of me. I'm me. It's not no reflection there. Then there's a little self and a big self. The conscious being that you are is the conscious being that Ishwara is the conscious being of the spider. You know, I'm using that spider analogy. I just saw on Facebook, this is the most cutest thing. Okay, there was this, like, like kind of a wide kind of pipe. I don't know, it was in somebody's home. It was like a circular pipe about like this, you know. And this spider, cute little spider, kind of not big, about like that, you know, was on top of the pipe, okay? And somebody put a mirror so that the spider could see itself, okay? You've seen this probably with dogs. They do it with dogs or with babies to see if the baby can recognize itself in the mirror, if the dog really or the cat really knows itself. I've never seen it done with a spider. Okay. So, I'd be happy to show you this event. I have it on my Facebook. So anyway, the spider, I don't know if it was actually, they were playing music in the background when I was watching it. There's background music accompanying it, but I don't know if it was played for the actual spider. But the spider, it had all its, you know, its tentacles, its little arms, and it was right up looking at the mirror, and it was going like this. Yeah. It was playing with itself, you know, looking at the mirror. And then going back, and then... And it's an obvious thing. It was honestly you know, trying to figure out what that was and playing with it. And then kind of almost dancing. He had his little hands out and was going like, ah. Spiders don't do this, okay? So it was just the cutest thing, and I thought, oh gosh. You know, because they're tiny, we underestimate their intelligence and their beingness because they're tiny, you know? It's an amazing thing. There's this one beautiful book called Animal Intelligence that's been written and by a woman, I forget her name now, I've got it. Actually, I have it on my Kindle. They've done a lot of research even on ants and ant colonies, and they've find that ants, actually the worker bees, some of the worker bees are in the position of being a teacher, and they actually teach the other ants by giving them jobs and following through and making sure that they've done it correctly, and if one is blowing it, they'll go back and, you know, find it and teach it and bring it along. It's a very, it involves thinking. There's a modicum of thinking there where they're actually training the worker bees that are coming behind them, you know, how to do their job, you know. And we have to, just because they're little, they're so tiny compared to us, we're such big giants. Imagine having a human being that we're the size of the ant, and we are who we are, with whatever intelligence or emotions that we have. And yet we are only the size of the ant to these big mammoth creatures walking along who stepping on us is totally irrelevant. We're nothing because we're so tiny compared to them. They can just walk along and crush us and crush us, and in their giant, gigantic bathtub they see, you know, some little ants in the bathtub and they just turn on the water and wash them down the drain. No problem. No guilt. And they're not given a second thought. You know. It's so interesting, you know, when you start becoming sensitive, it's kind of hard to live. you have to draw your boundaries, but, you know, It's a beautiful thing to become more and more sensitive. I used to pray for it because I felt like I was vegetarian and all of this because I felt it was the right way to be intellectually. I didn't feel it. It took me until much later in life. I wanted to feel like I knew Swamiji felt it from when he was from when I was 22, and I. From that period on, I could have so many experiences that it wasn't just following Dharma for him, which of course he would do, but no, he had empathy. It was empathy for those beings. It was empathy for the flower. You know, the beautiful flowers he would walk by when we'd be on our way to class in Powai when we were in India. And India has so many beautiful flowers. They're just blooming all of the time. And there was one particularly beautiful flower, and he just went up to it and he very gently touched it and just appreciated the beauty of it, and then he let it go, you know. And then he said something like, I would never pick a flower and ruin and end its life. Why would we do that? You know? And it was so real. It wasn't just some phony thing. You know, and then once, I've told the story many times because I've never forgotten it. Once he was kind of late to coming out for satsang, he was in his bath, and that was shut off from the satsang room. It was his kutir, but the bath was shut off, and he was sitting back there. He was late coming out, and apparently all of these little ants were in the shower area, you know. It's a bucket shower there, so all these ants were in the shower area, and so... You know, he had to take them all out. So, and so he was involved with, you know, taking all of these ants and taking them outside. And I was very impressed and moved by that because I knew that it was real for him, you know, to do that. But it wasn't real for me I would do something like that because I was practicing Dharma and I had a value for it, but my heart wasn't, the empathy wasn't there. And I always wanted it to be there, and I was thinking, why don't I feel like that? You know, I want to have those feelings too, but I don't, you know. And I even remember, not really so long ago, I mean, for me it's not 10, 15 years ago, it's not all that long ago, when my brother and sister, maybe I've told the story to you, I'll tell it again. My brother and sister used to come to the ashram on the East Coast, and they're not vegetarian or anything, they just eat whatever, their regular food. And so Swamiji really loved them and knew them, and every year he would meet them and watch the kids grow up for both families. And then whenever, no matter what, they were there together or one or the other was there, he would always say, give me $100. And he'd say, you take them out to have a nice meal, you know. And I said, okay, Swamiji. Because my brother was very poor, they couldn't have done that. You know, they just lived from month to month. He was in the army, that kind of thing. So we'd take them out. Then they would just order their regular food, hamburgers, whatever, you know. I was vegetarian, but I would never think to say, Swamiji gave us this, let's go eat, but let's have it be vegetarian. You know, it'll be vegetarian, we'll eat vegetarian because that would be respecting, you know, Swamiji's feelings. That thought never occurred to me. Never occurred to me. You know, if I had that opportunity, I haven't had that opportunity for many years, but I had that opportunity, I would of course say that. And every time I came back, you know, and see Swamiji at night, or we'd be meeting, you know, and he'd always say, you know, did you take them out? Yes, Swamiji. What did they eat? And I'd always say, Swamiji, please don't ask me that. Don't ask me. You know? Oh, okay, I'm sorry. But what should have been, had I had the sensitivity, he would have only, if he had to ask me that ever, it should have only been once. And from that time on, I would say, let's have a vegetarian, so that when Swamiji asks, I could say, you know, the Swamiji, everybody ate vegetarian, you know. And he would have been so happy, because it would have been like some consciousness around that. Even if they didn't feel, weren't vegetarians, they would be eating vegetarian, and some have some sort of value like that. It never, ever, once, even at my last meal with a family like that, never occurred. I'm really sad about it, but I mean, it's okay. I don't blame anything, any myself or anybody, but I just wish, you know. So that, having, growing into that type of empathy, it's an empathy that all beings deserve. They deserve that empathy. They are beings. Just like we can say, we deserve the empathy, you know. Like when Swamiji talks about Dharma, he says, yes, we all understand, innately understand Dharma. You don't have to be taught Dharma. It's innate. You understand it. Because you understand how you, as a human being, want to be treated. It doesn't, our weakness is that understanding of how I want to be treated because of my desires doesn't always mean that I will treat other people in that way, even though really I know that that's how they want to be treated also. But my desires and my needs can stop me from even acknowledging that. It's also, it can just abide subliminally. It's not totally unconscious, but it's something that can be kind of pushed to the side when my own desires, my own needs can override that. And so for me to become a mature person in terms of being a human being, I have to learn, I have to learn that to be able to understand Dharma not just in terms of my desires, but in terms of the desire of humans, my fellow beings. But then it also has to extend beyond that. It has to extend to all living beings. And for us to have, to allow that extension to take place requires a sacrifice of a lot of conditioning that we've grown up with in our culture. It requires a sacrifice of all of these things that have made us more or less comfortable, like the type of foods that we eat, the type of clothes that we wear, all of these things, you know, that are just prevalent in the culture. And when you're moving around in the culture, if you go to a store or go to a shoe store, it's almost 99% leather, you know. If you go to a restaurant, there may be one or two vegan things there. No, that's how it is. And so you have to give those things up, and you feel like that's a lot of sacrifice, you know, because the culture and the towns and whatnot and the shops, they're not as, don't serve you like they used to. They're not really serving you, because most of the things in those shops you can't use. Most of the things in those restaurants, you can't use, you know. And so you think it's too much of a sacrifice until you start giving them up, you know. And I know that for me, still to this day, being vegan, I feel a smile inside every time I'm out to dinner with friends, and I only have some, what do you call them, French fries. Because I feel in solidarity with the cows and all the little animals. I feel that. And I love that feeling. But you know, we can find, our empathy can keep growing. The empathy keeps growing until what you want for yourself is truly what you want for others. That's maturity. It takes time to really have that maturity. It's even hard to have that maturity for other human beings around the world. You know, beings the different types of, being from different types of cultures, and you know, people who are having so much difficulty around the world, to really care and not have it just be a television show. So empathy, you know, praying for that empathy. In fact, it's kind of hard to handle sometimes. But you feel so human as your empathy and care grows. It kind of unites you. It unites you deeply with the rest of the creation, with all of the beings. It unites you deeply with Ishwara. Unites you deeply with Dharma. Because even if we're doing unwittingly a Dharma, because our culture is a Dharmic, and so we grow up like a Rakshasa, we grow up in a Dharmic culture, and we only know these things, and we don't think of them as Dharma or a Dharma, that's what we grow up with. But they are a Dharma. If they're a Dharma, they're a Dharma. And they actually are very constricting to our being. Being means our soul. Yeah. And so as you discover and break out of the collective adharmas of our culture, and other cultures also, we're in Kali Yuga, and there's a tremendous freedom that takes place, because you're released from that adharma that you've not really been that consciously involved in, but nevertheless, it's kind of the example they use is, like, you didn't know the fire was hot. You didn't know that it shouldn't be touched. You didn't know that you shouldn't stick your hand in it. But say you stick your hand in it, you're burning. You're really burning. And at some point you have to, which probably be only half a second, but at some point you realize you have to pull your hand out. And then you're handling fire properly from then on, much more, you know, true to what it is. The Dharma is like that. You could be sitting in a Dharma for a really long, long time, and we're just taking for granted, without any thought, the type of constricted consciousness, yes, from the standpoint of the upadhi, that causes. You don't even know it until you get rid of it, until you outgrow it. So that type of a conscious, reflective life, you know, that type of care in terms of what you're doing and how you are and how you're behaving toward all beings is really worthwhile. These are the things where Swamiji says, don't waste your time keeping your head in the sand. It's a waste of time. You know, we can only change as fast as we can change, but that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. We do our best. But it's not worth it to waste your time keeping your head in the sand. It's better to just be with the situation as it is. Be brave. You have to be brave to be a mumukshu, to want to really gain self-knowledge, because you have to look at things as they are and then gain the proper tools to deal with these things. You know, it's good to be brave. It's fun. Worthwhile. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om. So, Ancestor Malakia Bhashan, for now, 12 verses.